Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The United States Department of Energy wants to reclassify as low-level waste 70,000 gallons of high-level nuclear waste in a cluster of tanks near the Columbia River. Doing this would allow the tanks to be filled with grout, leaving the waste at Hanford indefinitely. Over 2,000 comments and petitions gathered by a coalition of public interest groups and state and tribal governments highlight major flaws in this proposal. Today, we talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Tom Carpenter with Hanford Challenge about the next steps to ensure that Hanford gets a meaningful cleanup. Dan and Tom, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
You speak in unison.
Yes.
Well, before we actually start talking about Hanford, Dan, I wanted to reminisce for a few moments about this rather incredible hearing that happened in Longview on Thursday. So let's talk about what happened, what it was about, and why it was so impressive.
Yeah, many people listening may have actually been at this hearing. It was really a landmark moment for the push to stop the world's largest frac gas to methanol refinery. And over 1,000 people attended this hearing, a line wrapping around the building for more than an hour into the hearing as people tried to get in. There's somewhat of a connection between Hanford and that the U.S. Department of Energy is considering a $2 billion loan guarantee for this huge refinery. But there was a really loud, clear message that people sent to Cowles County, to the port, and to Governor Inslee that they need to turn down this project, which would be a huge polluter, would use about a third as much gas as the entire state of Washington. And what struck me was just that finally this is becoming a regional and statewide issue. It's something that's been, people in Kalama have been toiling away trying to get the attention of people throughout the region on this project, which would be huge. And I think they accomplished that on last week.
Well, from the perspective, I was sitting at the press box with several reporters from the Daily News, which is the local Longview paper. And so I got the impression of how it's been being covered by the local news. And people I've talked to in Kalama and Longview for years have complained about how there is really no coverage of anything going on in that part of Cowles County, which is one county north of Clark County. And that their only local news source is the Longview Daily News. They can hear Oregon Public Broadcasting and KBOO there, but they're not usually on the radar of either stations. So I'm glad that KBOO is giving an opportunity to get a word out, because I really got a sense of how it's being covered in the Daily News. I guess you said, Dan, when we were there Thursday night, that they were reporting that there were more people in support of the refinery proposal.
The coverage evolved during the course of the evening, and several of us had noted that the early versions of the story did not accurately represent the incredibly skewed nature of the crowd, which was overwhelmingly opposed to the project. I mean, if you looked out of the room, it was a sea of red shirts, and that wasn't how the Daily News originally characterized it. In their defense, they did get it more correct in their later reporting, their revised reporting.
However, I mean, they did say it was overwhelmingly opposition, but then they said that 73% of the people who were attending were not from Cowles County. And they made a big point about that. And I found one of the interesting arithmetical items they had was that they said that there were twice as many people from Portland as there were from Kalama or Longview. Well, there were 110 people from Portland, I think. There were 58 people from Kalama and like 49 from Longview. Well, if you add it together, it's not twice as many as those two towns. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it, I think about it, the number of people who live in Portland versus the people who live in Longview. And there, I think we probably had a smaller representation of Portlanders than they're from Cowles County. But getting back to what you said about it becoming a real regional issue, the fact is, and this is what the Longview Daily News seems to miss and what the proponents of the facility seem to miss, is that this is not just a concern for people who live in Cowles County. It's really a concern for people all over the planet, basically, but certainly people all over the Northwest. How do you think that this coalition or this awareness has arrived to the moment where people are coming from up and down the I-5 corridor to be at that hearing?
Well, I credit a lot of the people who've been doing organizing locally in Kalama, continuing to make those connections with people in Tacoma and Seattle, and making those connections with people in Portland and, you know, a little further south, and really converging these common struggles around huge frac gas infrastructure, whether it's Tacoma LNG, Jordan Cove LNG, or these huge methanol refineries proposed. People are starting to see through the greenwashing, that these projects have any role in a low-carbon future. And the Seattle Times just ran a big story this morning, and it quoted Pete Erickson from the Stockholm Environmental Institute, who said this project doesn't have a place in a low-carbon future. And so I think we're making a dent, we're making an impact, and we really need Governor Inslee to take note of this and to step in and to review this project where the port and the county have largely failed to do so.
Well, I got an email from Onward, Oregon today, and they're urging people to email Governor Inslee.
Great.
And I imagine they can find out how to do that on your website as well.
Absolutely.
Well, now we're going to move on to Hanford, which I know keeps you up at night, Dan, probably as much, if not more, than frack gas in the Northwest. So, and I want to bring Tom in. Welcome, Tom, back to the show. And maybe we'll start with you, Tom. I wanted to just kind of back up a little bit and talk about this, what this reclassification of high-level waste means and why the Department of Energy is trying to do this.
Well, sure. You know, for folks who are listening, we're talking about the Hanford nuclear site, and it's about a couple hundred miles upstream from Portland. This site is a former plutonium production facility and currently one of the most contaminated facilities in the world, certainly in the United States. And it contains about two-thirds of the nation's high-level nuclear waste. And high-level nuclear waste is, you know, a particular form of nuclear waste that's long-lived, highly radioactive, and something that you can't destroy. You can't neutralize it. So it has to decay away. And the problem with this stuff is that it's dangerous in such tiny quantities and lasts such a long time that essentially it outlasts any container that you put it in. We're talking millions of years, and it can cause extreme biological damage, cancer, mutations, and the like. And so Hanford has two-thirds of that stuff of its inventory of high-level waste for the entire nation, stored in underground nuclear waste tanks. There's also a lot that was dumped to the soils around the tanks, you know, either deliberately or that leaked out. And this has been why Hanford is so expensive. We've spent, as taxpayers, over $45 billion on Hanford cleanup since 1989. And 20 of that, half of that, has gone into these tanks. And clearly the government is tired of paying for it and has now proposed a solution of sorts, that is to call the nuclear waste in the tanks something else other than high-level waste, such as, you know, low-activity waste, for instance. And so this is a formal proposal that has popped up in two different ways. One, in a local comment period, as the Hanford officials have proposed to shut down and close a set of nuclear waste tanks called the Steam Farm tanks. And they're proposing to leave waste in these tanks, about 500,000 curies of radioactivity there, when, you know, even a billionth of a curie can be a problem dose for the long term, and put concrete in these tanks and walk away from it. But they couldn't do that if it were high-level waste, and they know that. That would be against the law. So the solution, this is a Trumpian solution, by the way, would simply be rename it. Let's pretend it's something else. It's not high-level waste anymore, and now it's something else. Well, now on a national level, at headquarters of the Department of Energy, there is a similar proposal that's now open for public comment until January 9th that would propose doing the same thing, basically giving this department, the Department of Energy, which is the agency that owns the Hanford site, the ability to rename the waste so they don't have to clean it up. And why are they doing this? Well, it's simple: to save $40 to $45 billion in cleanup costs, and that's by their own reckoning. They save that money simply by just not doing the cleanup, leaving the waste where it is.
Well, I have the impression that a lot of the money that's gone into cleanup at Hanford has actually been wasted because they keep changing course, like every 4 to 8 years, depending on who's president. And this seems to be the most dramatic change of course yet. But I wonder if either one of you have a sense of some of the other ways that money was spent that basically just kind of, I guess, went into the groundwater working towards the Columbia River like the waste is doing.
Tom, you probably have the longest perspective on that question, so I'll let that go to you.
Well, yeah, there have been a lot of projects at Hanford over the years, over the decades, that ended in failure. And I'll hasten to say that there have been some successful projects ongoing out there, too, so it's not entirely been a waste of money. So a lot of cleanup has happened along the river. Groundwater filtration has been regarded as a success, and if they keep that up, it will help a lot. But all of that, the groundwater cleanup, the shoreline cleanups, you know, tearing down buildings, et cetera, will be for naught. It won't mean anything if the high-level waste inventories are not removed, treated, and disposed of. So the true waste would be having spent all that money cleaning up the shorelines and cleaning up the groundwater and removing some of the smaller inventories of waste from around the site. If big contaminated plumes containing high-level waste travel through the site and into the river over time, which is what's going to happen if they don't remove the waste from these tanks.
Well, one of the things that really blows my mind, I've been out to Hanford a few times, and the last time I was out there, which was, I think, about 14 years ago, I actually got a tour of the sea tanks, the sea tank farm. And at that time, the two people that I was, who were my tour guides, were very forthright about what was in there, what the problems were, their fear of those tanks leaking in the near future. And actually, I think shortly after I was there, some of those tanks did start to leak. And that there was no messing around back in 2002 about what was in those tanks. What has shifted, besides the fact that Trump is president, that we can do something as egregious as call stuff that's obviously been appreciated as high-level waste for the last 60-some-odd years, 70 years, to be calling it now low-level waste?
Hey, Dan, why don't you take that one?
I think you hit the nail on the head. Which is, President Trump. You know, it is very much a function of Rick Perry being the Secretary of Energy that we're seeing these proposals now. The idea of reclassifying high-level waste was really a rehash of something that happened in the Bush administration. It's one of the worst ideas that the second Bush administration put forward in terms of the nuclear waste problem at Hanford, and it didn't proceed. And so we're looking for the state of Washington to continue to push back on that effort. But this bigger idea of simply changing the definition of high-level waste nationwide is a step that is new and novel. It's a truly Trumpian approach to high-level waste where I think Tom said it perfectly, which is this isn't a matter of doing the cleanup faster or cheaper. This is a matter of not doing the cleanup and simply leaving this material in the soil to move into groundwater, to move into the Columbia River. It's as simple as that. And yes, that does save you $40 or $45 billion if you simply walk away and don't do the cleanup. But the state of Washington and the federal government have always had an agreement that they would address this contamination and this pollution and protect people along the Columbia River and downstream, protect future generations. And what we're seeing right now is the Trump administration rushing headlong towards abrogating that agreement and walking away. After decades of work at Hanford, something else Tom said, which I really think is powerful, is that is a waste if you decide not to address this most central problem at Hanford. You know, most people who know about Hanford know about the tanks. And it's really a centerpiece of the problem there. A lot of the contamination that you find in groundwater extending all the way towards the Columbia River comes from that area. And the Trump administration is poised now to try to simply wave a wand and call high-level waste something else. And that's really alarming. I haven't been at this nearly as long as Tom, but I can see clearly that this is one of the biggest crossroads that Hanford cleanup has ever come to. And, you know, it's really a question of whether we're going to allow the federal government to walk away and to leave this pollution to future generations into the state.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, who you just heard, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Tom Carpenter, who's on the phone from Seattle, who's with Hanford Challenge. We're talking about the next steps to ensure that Hanford gets a meaningful cleanup. So there were a number of hearings around the region. Let's talk a little bit about the hearings and what kind of turnout was there. And what were the hearings about?
Yeah, they really only held... They held a couple meetings. They didn't actually hold any public hearings where they took public testimony. And that was frustrating because people had a lot to say. And they would have been there to give formal public testimony if they were given the opportunity. So the federal government held one informational meeting shortly after announcing the waste incidental to reprocessing idea back in June of 2018, earlier this summer. You know, that happened on very short notice, and it was an all-day meeting in Richland. So really not the type of thing you would expect a lot of people from the public to attend. The second bite of the apple came actually thanks to Oregon Department of Energy, who, seeing a gap in public engagement, they decided to hold their own meeting in Portland, and that was very well attended. There were at least 100 people there, many of whom spoke very clearly to the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, urging them to pull back this proposal. And by that time, this larger idea had come forward of reinterpreting the actual definition of high-level waste nationwide. And what Department of Energy is talking about there really would turn cleanup on its head by removing the requirement that they actually take out some of the key radionuclides, removing the requirement that the waste be incorporated in a solid form. So it takes several steps towards making it very, very easy to call high-level waste something else. Really, the only thing that they would have to do is to write a technical document called a performance assessment, and that would allow them to reclassify waste or to simply say it's not high-level waste. So at that meeting, there was a very clear sense from the people present that this was both these ideas, the reclassification of waste at the sea farm and the reinterpretation of the term high-level waste. These were both mistakes. And then in Hood River, just a couple weeks after that, on November 1st, they held a state of the site or regional dialogue type meeting that covered many different topics. But again, clearly there was a sense from the members of the public who attended that they did not want to see the Department of Energy proceed with these things. And when it came to time for the comment period to close, there were thousands of people, including hundreds of tribal members from Yakima Nation, who weighed in against this idea of reinterpreting and reclassifying high-level waste. And a lot of credit for that and the outpouring of concern goes to people who've been at this for a long time, like Tom, who were able to say, look, this is a big deal. This is a departure from where we've been and a departure from the agreements between the state of Washington and the federal government to protect our river and Hanford and the people of Washington.
So what's the upshot of all this response?
So far, we don't have a response to comment document for the sea farm. We're waiting for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to publish their own consideration of this whole issue. And in 2019, we'll see, potentially by fall of 2019, whether they intend to actually reclassify this waste. And we may see also in 2019 whether they intend to reinterpret the definition of high-level waste. So that's 2019 is going to be a big year for determining the future of those tanks at Hanford.
And you're going to be getting very little sleep, I take it. Many sleepless nights worrying about this.
Yes.
Well, I guess it seems like being the Trump administration, it would be a done deal unless there is some other mechanism where the public can really weigh in even more strongly than writing comments. Is there a way? I know that you just don't change rules in the federal government like with a wand of the executive order that Trump thinks you can. But it does sound like the whole process still feels a little bit rigged to me.
Well, let me weigh in on that one. It's yes, if it stays in the regulatory sphere, but it won't stay there. So when the Department of Energy, you know, makes an official move to say it's not a proposal anymore, now it is the way it is, then that will invite litigation. So the courts, as they have on so many other occasions, been invited in to make a ruling on whether or not the department, you know, has the authority to do what it wants to do. And this has already been the subject of a lawsuit back in 2002 and 2003 when an Idaho federal judge acting there's a suit lodged by Idaho activist group, and then the National Natural Resources Defense Council and the Yakima Indian Nation sued over a DOE's interpretation back then that they could relabel high-level waste at Hanford. The federal judge in that case said, oh, yeah, no, you can't do that. You don't have the authority of the Department of Energy to go contrary to what the statute explicitly describes as what high-level waste is. And it's a source-based definition that comes from the reprocessing of nuclear fuels. And that's what Congress said it was. And the Department of Energy threw in, well, if it's too expensive to treat this waste, then it's not high-level waste. And the judge says, well, I don't know where you got that from, and ruled against the department. The response to that from the Department of Energy was to appeal it, of course, to the Ninth Circuit on the one hand, and on the other hand, go to Congress and seek Congress's permission to do some of this renaming. And on the Ninth Circuit said, well, we're not sure that the DOE is actually going to go ahead and do this, therefore the decision isn't ripe for adjudication. It was a pretty conservative panel they had there. But that was it. It was basically a procedural, turn back of the decision, but nothing's changed in the law or with DOE and what they're proposing to do since that time. So we feel pretty confident that a court would rule in the same manner, given today's circumstances. Congress, on the other hand, did change the law as to two states, South Carolina and Idaho, but not for Washington and not for New York, which were also in there. So it became a very convoluted state of the law type of thing. What we're anticipating happening here is that there likely will be litigation probably in 2019, and that DOE will go to Congress and attempt to get Congress to change the law. And we do have, of course, a different constituency control of Congress issue with the House in being run now by Democrats, and in particular Adam Smith from the state of Washington becoming the chair of the House Armed Services Committee. And that committee controls the authorization of what the Department of Energy can and cannot do. So we've got some hopes there that Adam Smith is able to use his power to bottle up the Department of Energy's plans on this, and let's get through to 2021 when we have a new administration and maybe back to where we should be on the cleanup issues.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Adam Smith for a second, because his name has been popping up a lot in the fight around frack gas, and where he's a beneficiary, I think the highest beneficiary of Puget Sound Energy funding for his campaigns of any elected official in Washington. So I'm just wondering, how would you compare his stand around Hanford with his stand, or Hanford cleanup with his stand around the methanol refinery in Kalama, for example, and the LNG facility in Tacoma?
This is a tricky one in that, these issues are quite distinct. In that, we see several elected leaders who have been approached and certainly have close ties to the natural gas industry, the fracked gas industry. that industry has greenwashed itself to the extent that they are very well integrated into, Democratic politics. And that's a long-term struggle to try to disentangle the fracked gas industry from,
the Democratic Party.
From the Democratic Party, to be honest. But on this issue, what we see is there's always been a sense, I think really a bipartisan sense around Hanford, an agreement that Washington should not be the dumping ground for high-level nuclear waste. I've always thought, that we had broad regional consensus on at least this idea that high-level waste is high-level waste. To quote the Hanford Advisory Board, plutonium is forever, end quote. And this is stuff we really need to address. And so I think it really makes a lot of sense for Washington's congressional delegation to stand firm on this and to speak up, and for Oregon's to speak up. We saw Senator Wyden make a fairly strong statement that this is a big proposed change. and for Hanford and for the entire nuclear waste complex around the United States. So we're going to have to push these folks on both fronts. And it's always important for us to be, you know, have open lines of communication and to find places of agreement. I think we broadly agree that Hanford's high-level nuclear waste should be addressed. And this idea from the Trump administration is really a huge step outside of the broad regional consensus we've had for decades around this contamination.
Well, I'm going to harp on the Adam Smith issue for just one more moment. What's his track record around Hanford?
Tom would know good. Better.
From my perspective, he has been really great on both his votes as well as in stopping DOE, meeting with us and hearing from us when DOE... So, for instance, he was a key ally in protecting Hanford workers when it came to, you know, exposure to chemical vapors. He was important in stopping the DOE from putting some provisions in through the National Defense Authorization Act that DOE wanted that would have made it easier for DOE to try to skate away on a cleanup. I consider him a good ally on Hanford, and I can't object to anything that he's done on Hanford, actually. I think he hasn't had the power to do a whole lot, of course, in the last several years because he's been a minority chair, but even then, he's been able to exercise power. So he's been great for us on Hanford.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Tom Carpenter with Hanford Challenge, you just heard, and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about the next steps to ensure that Hanford gets a meaningful cleanup. One of the things that I think about in terms of dealing with Hanford is how much disinformation and outright lying has gone on, that in a way this Trumpian reclassification of high-level waste doesn't feel that much different from a lot of the other lies that I've heard. And I was thinking about the last time I was at Hanford interviewing the communications person from the floor company, whatever, the main contractor for the cleanup. And I think they're still the main contractor, aren't they? Floor.
They're one of them.
One of them. Okay.
Well, Tom would know better than I. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, this is back in 2002. And this guy said to me, he was describing how they actually dumped low-level waste in unlined trenches for decades, starting during World War II. But then he said, but we are no longer doing this. And he said it several times. And I was a few years later interviewing Jerry Pollitt, and I mentioned that to him. And he said, no, they're still doing it. And this was like 10 years later. So how do we, first of all, track that what's going on in Hanford is what they say is going on? And what kind of watchdogging can happen to make sure that they're doing the right thing?
Well, so on the one hand, that's why groups like Columbia Riverkeeper and Hanford Challenge and Heart of America are out there, is DOE has almost no credibility when it comes to talking about the Hanford site anymore. It's hard to believe anything that they say. This latest issue of holding public meetings to explain what they're doing on the reclassification of high-level waste is a great example of the DOE approach of, we're going to come tell you what we're doing, but we're not going to listen to you. They won't take any public comment. In fact, if people try to say something during the course of the meeting that they didn't want to hear, their facilitator shut it down real hard and real quick and said, no, you can only ask questions. And of course, you know, they had practiced all kinds of answers to make it sound slick, and you couldn't ask a follow-up. I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of the in line with what Trump wants to do across the board is, you know, worried about climate change. They're not. Why? Because it's not happening. Even though clearly climate change is one of the biggest threats humanity is facing, it's just more convenient for the administration to call it a hoax. And it's the same with the nuclear waste now. They haven't called it a hoax, but, you know, they're basically saying we can just leave it there and now we don't have to clean it up, ha, ha, ha. And, you know, that's a very worrisome approach all around on it. So, I think that one of the most important sources of information for the public is whistleblowers on the inside. And it's something that, you know, we've put a lot of effort and energy into, is to make sure that those insiders have a safe haven at Hanford Challenge to come forward. They get legal representation here. They get advocacy. We put them in touch with the news media, with Congress, with state regulators, and amplify their voices. So the inside information, the truth about what's going on at Hanford, is often brought out by these insiders who have brought news about everything from leaking tanks to missing plutonium to, you know, waste problems much worse than we thought, fraud, abuse, nuclear safety concerns. In fact, almost every major issue that you can think of or name at the Hanford site came about because of either whistleblowers or a public interest group putting that news out there, because Hanford itself doesn't do it. In fact, they argue with the news for a while until the documents start surfacing and et cetera. Then they ignore the fact that it came from a whistleblower from a public interest group and put it out there like they said it. But yeah, there's a big credibility problem with Hanford. It's been there forever. I don't think it'll ever go away, I guess, you know, as long as this agency's in charge of this cleanup out there.
Can you give me an example of a case where a whistleblower came forward with something that has been very revealing and has maybe changed the course of at least public opinion about what's going on?
Well, I think a recent one is you know, Hanford has been building a waste treatment plant at the Hanford site to treat the waste in the tanks and glassify it. So people might have heard the term vitrification. And it's a way to take nuclear waste and solidify it into a glass form so it can be stored and disposed of in a deep geological repository. And Hanford has had a really tough time coming up with the facility to make this happen. And some insiders, and they were key high-level managers and engineers, were asked to basically sign off on that this plant's ready to go. We can pivot from design and construction of this facility to construction and commissioning, meaning we can open it up pretty soon. And this was in 2010. And the chief engineer for research and technology, a guy named Dr. Tamasitis, said, no, you've got these 50 concerns, you know, involving the possibility of nuclear waste explosions, hydrogen gas, you know, nuclear criticalities, 50 major issues that have been unresolved. And so he wouldn't go along with it. And he was fired immediately, marched out. And this is a guy who was, you know, what, third from the top, basically. So if they could do that to him, they could do it to anyone. And it sent reverberations throughout the whole Hanford system. And other people spoke up with similar issues, so that, you know, within the year, you had the chief engineer of the facility, the manager of nuclear safety and environmental safety, also blowing the whistle, Donna Bushy, the chief scientist, all raising concerns about the design and construction of the waste treatment plant. Eventually, this, you know, made its way to congressional oversight hearings, as well as big coverage in USA Today and the Rachel Maddow Show. And this led to the Secretary of Energy visiting the site, because they had to look like they're at least look like they're doing something. This was not in the Obama administration, by the way. So this was Secretary Moniz. When he took a tour of the site, he suspended all construction and design work. This was in 2012. And so within 2 years, these whistleblowers had managed to expose these very dramatic safety issues that the department and the contractor were willing to just, you know, take a risk on. And yet the secretary came out, took a look at it, and said, no, the whistleblowers are right. You know, really the plant had to undergo a total design review and change and reconstruction in some cases. And they're just now starting to recover from that. And, you know, I'm sad about the fact that they screwed it up so badly that it had to be delayed on the one hand because we need a vitrification treatment facility. On the other, you can't have a plant that is a nuclear nightmare and a nuclear safety risk for the region that's supposed to clean up the waste. So that's the most recent kind of dramatic example of how whistleblowers have changed the course of history at the Hanford site.
Well, let's talk a little bit about vitrification. Actually, we got a question from a listener who wants to have us explain how the waste can be contained. Can is underscored. Mm-hmm. But starting with vitrification, the first time I went to Hanford was in, I think, 1982. And they were touting vitrification, and I left my visit with a little black marble that had no, I was told I had no plutonium in it, but, and it seemed like it was a lot easier to make this little black marble out of glass than it was to actually turn the nuclear waste into glass. And the next time I went out to Hanford, I think the next year, they had turned away from vitrification. It seems like they had been bouncing back and forth with that for 35 years or more. So what, why has it been so hard for this process to work? Because I understand actually in France, they got it to work.
Well, so it's Tom again. It's partly because, and by the way, we are vitrifying waste in South Carolina at the Savannah River facility. The difference between Hanford's waste and everyone else's is that Hanford has a very complicated system of waste tanks. So each and every waste tank basically is its own unique container of nasty chemicals and radioactive materials. And there's 177 tanks. So you have 56 million gallons of waste. So the volumes are immense, much higher than anywhere else in the world. And the chemical complexity of the soup in these tanks is also staggering. So, you know, when you come to needing to treat this waste and mix it into glass, you have to have two things. One is you have to know the feed going into the, you know, what is going into the glass. So you have to have kind of a uniform, predictable mix of chemicals. Why? Because you're going to put them in this high heat process, and the wrong combination of chemicals can result in, what they call deflagrations, which is catching on fire, or ignitions, which is explosion. So, you know, you could have a bad day if you haven't controlled your chemical feed very well. The other is the glass won't work if you have certain chemicals in there or metals such as chromium, which can cause gapping and weaken the glass, et cetera. So, depending on the recipe that you're using, and that was one thing. The other thing is, Bechtel, I'll just channel a remark I heard from an oversight board chair who once said publicly, the reason the waste treatment plant is in such trouble is that the Department of Energy and the contractor have looked at it like a chemical plant with nuclear capabilities, handling nuclear waste, when they should have looked at it as a nuclear plant, you know, with chemistry involved. But because of that, they did not design and build the plant appropriately using nuclear grade qualifications, right? So the steel, the components, the design, the workmanship, all of that was not uniformly done with nuclear safety requirements in mind. So they took too many shortcuts, installed too many components that were not nuclear qualified, and that got them in big trouble. So that ended up being one of the more expensive things that they ended up having to rework is tearing out materials, steel, for instance, or concrete that just wasn't up to snuff for a nuclear facility. And it really remains to be seen whether they've done enough of that into the future.
Well, Dan, let's get back to the other part of this core of the question that this caller had, was how can the waste be contained? Is there a way to do this?
Yeah, we've seen the Department of Energy have some success in, for instance, well, there's different ways of removing and containing the waste. They have a big pump and treat system out there where it tries to intercept groundwater, treat that groundwater, remove radioactive material. know, some of that contamination is originating from the tank farm area. And so that's one, is like trying to nab it as it's on its way to the river. I think the real fundamental question here is, what do you do with this worst stuff, this 56 million gallons? And as, you know, a region, we've really invested in this idea that we are going to contain it in the most stable form possible and ultimately dispose of it in a deep geologic repository. And that has not yet been identified. What Department of Energy is proposing to do here is to simply use the soil and the groundwater at Hanford as the storage, to leave it, you know, in tanks that they know will fail, that have failed. You know, one of the other classic whistleblower issues in recent history was the identification that some of these tanks that were double shell tanks had begun to leak. And that was a big wake-up call about the need to address the tank farm system as a whole. So while really intelligent, well-meaning people have been struggling with these difficult issues for decades, in comes the Trump administration proposing to simply call high-level waste something else so that they can shortcut their way out of the cleanup entirely. And that is, that's an insulting proposal for people like Tom, who've worked on this for decades, but also to people at Hanford who've invested careers in trying to tackle some of these really difficult issues and trying to find the best way to turn this really disastrously dangerous material, this contamination, into a glass log or something else, and find a way to put it, you know, where it won't harm people in the environment for hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of years. The Columbia River flows through this place in a free-flowing stretch that is one of really the jewels of the whole Columbia River system. And, you know, we fully support continuing to press to find solutions for these very difficult problems. And that cannot happen if the Department of Energy throws up its hands and says, well, you know, if we can't figure out what to do with the high-level waste, we're just going to call it something else.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Dan Sears, you just heard, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Tom Carpenter, who's speaking to us from Seattle, who's with Hanford Challenge, about how to ensure that Hanford actually gets a meaningful cleanup after the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, is trying to reclassify 70,000 gallons of high-level waste as low-level waste. Well, getting back to these tank farms, the last time I was out there in 2002, I think there was still waste in the single shell tanks, which were leaking and started leaking, as I recall, soon after I moved to Portland in 71. I remember seeing articles about the single shell tanks leaking into the ground and concern about it eventually making it into the groundwater. So when I was there in 2002, they were at that point pumping all the single shell tank waste into double shell tanks. So I'm wondering what's happened in the ensuing 16 years, and now I guess also the double shell tanks are leaking as well.
Yeah, so that's one of the big challenges is, you know, what you saw in 2002, the fact that there had been material already leaked into the soil. There's at least a million gallons, probably more, of high level waste that's been released into the soil underneath these tanks. One of the big tricks that Department of Energy tried to pull with its reclassification in the sea farm was by ignoring what it was already in the soil. So they were saying, you know, the worst case risk you would ever see in the life of this material in the tank is, you know, this amount is X, ignoring the fact that if you were to dig into the ground beneath those tanks right now, the contamination that's already there far exceeds the number that they put out as being the risk driver. So they're essentially closing their eyes to the contamination that is already in the environment. The goal here for Department of Energy is to fill those tanks with cement and to leave them forever, and to hope in the meantime that they have enough double shell tank space to continue to hold the liquid component. And that's a real challenge. You know, the Hanford Advisory Board, the state of Washington, groups like Hanford Challenge and Columbia Riverkeeper have urged the federal government to invest in new tank space because we think they have a real problem, that this is extremely old and aging infrastructure. And unless they, you know, take some interim steps to find more storage, it's going to end up in the ground. And that makes it very difficult to address. It also creates this sort of perverse incentive later, which is material that's leaked into the soil apparently is not treated as high-level waste by this Department of Energy. And it's something that just was very, very galling to see that those leaks were not included in the analysis.
So it looks like the future, the near future of Hanford would be just to have to build more and more double shell tanks. But we're looking at, what, 240,000 years of this waste being dangerous. So how long can you just keep building more tanks?
Well, you can't, and that's not the goal. Building new tanks is simply to protect the groundwater from new leaks, because right now they don't have enough tank space to contain the radioactive waste were a new leak to occur at a serious rate. And most of the liquids, free liquids or easy to get liquids in the single shell tanks have been moved over to the double shell tanks. And as you pointed out, now the double shell tanks have started to fail. So we've had one that had to be emptied and closed, and AY-101, and others are on their way to a failure mode. So, knowing that we're not going to have vitrification anytime soon, and you have to do something, then some new tanks are needed. However, nobody thinks that's a long-term solution. The long-term solution is the one that we've been working on for quite a while, which is remove the waste from these tanks, vitrify it, and put it into a deep geological repository. And we're not there yet. It hasn't happened. But that is the deadlines, with the state of Washington and the EPA, that's what we're driving towards. And the DOE keeps dancing, trying to change the law, trying to shuffle out of the way so they don't have to do that. And I don't get why. I think that it's really important that this waste get removed from these tanks, treated, and put into a deep geological repository. That's the solution that we've got for nuclear waste right now. We don't have a way to neutralize it. This is simply, more closing the Trump administration and the DOE closing its eyes to the real threat in order to, save money over the long run. And it's got to stop. They've got to be stopped.
Well, one of the other concerns, though, is we're pretty far away, it seems, from having determined the deep repository site that we would use for storing all this waste. I mean, it's not going to be Hanford, which back my first time out in Hanford in the early 80s, they were planning on putting it in Gable Mountain. That's long gone. Yucca Mountain, I guess, well, Harry Reid's no longer in Congress, so maybe they can go back to Yucca Mountain, which I think is what Trump was looking at. But is there a site that is actually doable?
Well, that's a big question, and it's doable. There is a Blue Ribbon Commission started by Obama that has a set of principles for how do you locate and get a site going. And unfortunately, that work was stopped, when Trump took over. But that Blue Ribbon Commission said, first you have to have scientifically defensible place, and qualify a site, before you select it, which is the problem with Yucca Mountain. Is they said, this is it, and we'll qualify it as we go along, and that turned out not to be an easy thing to do. In fact, it wasn't going to be a good location, it turns out. But as important is the community acceptance, around the state, local communities, et cetera. People impacted, the tribes and the areas have to be okay with it, meaning you have to get them on board. There are locations where that might be possible to do, but if you don't do that, those same stakeholders will become your worst enemy and probably, like Nevada, took on the federal government on this and stopped the Yucca Mountain Project. And, it was designed in a political way, and it died in a political way. But this Blue Ribbon Commission said, you need to do it differently. And there are examples. So Finland is the one example where they've successfully buried high-level waste, spent nuclear fuel in Onkalo, which is about a mile deep into granite. And that facility is either up and running or about to start, one or the other. I'm not sure which. And we do have a plutonium repository in New Mexico called WIP, which is not a paragon of a great example, but at least we do have some nuclear waste disposal going on in salt wells in New Mexico and Texas, basically. So there, you know, it can be done, and there's ways to do it right, but we're just not doing that yet.
I'm just curious, are there any sites in mind? I mean, because I've heard a lot of negative stuff about the websites, and salt mines in particular have issues with water and other things that can contaminate the site. So what do you know of that would be possible sites, or what kind of geological formations would actually work?
Well, granite is what keeps coming up. So the issue is this: it's got to be below a water table, in a formation where you're going to have to just no container that you design, steel, concrete, the best stuff we can make is going to last as long as these wastes last. Right, so it's not just plutonium, which is around for 240,000 years, but technetium-99, which is going to be 1.1 million years. It's going to be around that long, and et cetera. So you've got some very long-lived radionuclides that essentially can't be allowed to enter into the river systems, into the food, into the air, and to circulate through life forms essentially forever. That should not be allowed to happen. And maybe we ought to be thinking about making this stuff in the first place, since we don't know how to handle it, but that's another argument at another time. Right now, we are stuck with these large inventories of this radioactive waste, and do we want to leave it on a site that has a major river system flowing through it, the Columbia River, that is riddled with earthquake faults, next to major active volcanoes, and undergoes periodic geological flooding every 20,000 to 50,000 years, where the whole site's underwater for decades. It's just obviously this is not what we had in mind, what scientists had in mind when they said a dry, stable, deep geological repository. Anything you store on that site is going to end up in the living systems on this planet if you leave it there. So we can't leave it there.
Well, one last thing. I read this interesting book about Yucca Mountain a few years ago, and the writer was talking about how would you let future generations know what was buried in these sites? How can you foretell? And I think he was only going 250,000 years ahead in time, as opposed to like over 1 million years, I mean, which is longer than humans as we know them have been on the earth. I mean, how would you have markers that people could understand that this is something really dangerous and you need to stay away from it?
You know, one answer I heard to that question was from a recently passed away leader of the Yakima Nation who said, "We'll tell them. We were here in the beginning. We will be here in the end. And we'll tell people."
Is that Russell Jim?
Yeah, and he's passed away and was someone from whom I know Tom and I and pretty much everyone learned a tremendous amount about that question, about what it means to abandon this material in someone's sacred place, in someone's home, next to someone's river. You know, people have been cordoned off the Hanford nuclear site for decades now, and that includes people who have the right to be there and have been there since time immemorial, and that's one of the motivating elements for this whole discussion about high-level waste is to see such high engagement from the leaders, who've taken up after the passing of the program manager, and have kept this issue out front and saying we cannot abandon this here. We cannot poison this land for the people to whom it rightfully belongs.
Well, one last thing. How can listeners get involved in making sure that this high-level waste is not reclassified as low-level waste?
We have a link on our website at ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org, and Hanford Challenge has a really good good fact sheet on this. If you're interested in learning more, I think it's HanfordChallenge.org on this specific issue. There's also information there, we didn't get to it today, about the U.S. Department of Energy suing the state of Washington to try to void their effort in protecting workers on the site. So with that, I'll just pitch it to Tom.
Okay, we only get about 1 minute left, and we'll have these links on the Locus Focus site as well. So one moment, Tom, how can you explain this lawsuit that's going on right now?
Well, it's going to occur in court. So at this point, the Department of Justice has sued to block the worker compensation reforms put in by the state of Washington. And so that'll be tried in court, you know, in the next year. People really do need to communicate with the governor, with their governor, their congressional delegations about not letting the DOE relabel this waste. That is the big issue right now. And there's a public comment period that goes through January 9th. You can read about that on Columbia River Keepers' website and Hanford Challenges' website and others, or send a comment to hlwnotice@em.doe.gov. Not that anyone's going to run and get a pin, but you know.
Right, but it's on the website, and you can get Hanford right. Challenge and Columbia River Keeper websites are easy to find, and we'll have links on the Locus Focus website for that as well.
Yeah.
I want to thank you guys both very much for joining us today. Keep up the good work, and we'll check in, I guess, when the next time there's a new developing.
Yeah, well, thanks for so much for you know, the great interview. You're obviously very knowledgeable and ask great questions.
Well, thanks a lot. Thank you,
thank you,
Tom and Dan.
Okay, thank you.
We've been talking this morning with Dan Sears with Columbia River Keeper and Tom Carpenter with Hanford Challenge, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll hear some of the testimony given at the Puget Sound. No, actually, we're going to hear the testimony given at in Longview about the Kalama Methanol Refinery. And we'll be focusing on that and giving you more information on how you can make comments to stop that refinery. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Charles Mingus. Thanks for listening.
Peace title. Oh Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me.